Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
My dog is on Xanax. Now, let me explain what I'm talking about real fast. Tonight's broadcast is about fear. We're going to talk about the science of fear. I have a scientist on fear who's going to help us explore the human brain and find out how these things happen and how to perhaps treat it. We're going to talk about our own phobias, the things that freak us out, rational and irrational fears. And just have a good time in advance of the Ghost Stories broadcast, which will happen next Tuesday. But I've got this little rescue dog who, if you followed my story over the past year and a half, you know that little Henry has become one of the great joys of my life. I actually produced a video about his rescue. I have a couple little dogs. Tootsie, I call her Rat Dog, and then Henry, who looks kind of like a bat, so he's Bat Dog. Rat Dog and Bat Dog. And so, you know, like the storm comes along and the thunder and the lightning are just going crazy outside. You know, Rat Dog doesn't care. It's chilling out. It's no big deal. Like it doesn't even exist. But Henry just goes into this weird, convulsing, catatonic, wide-eyed, just a manifestation of absolute fear. And he had been kept in a cage in a puppy mill where they breed dogs. For the vets estimated his age to be about 8. He was born there, so that's 8 years in a cage, okay, essentially. And they were kept, when he was found, in a mobile home, one of those single-wide mobile homes. There's 100-plus dogs in a single mobile home. So I'm trying to imagine if you have storm anxiety and you're in this enclosed space with 100-plus dogs, and lightning flashes outside the window, and the thunder just pounds this metal room, this metal building. Now, no wonder he's all screwed up. And it breaks my heart every time it happens. In the middle of the night, we'll be lying there. I won't know in advance that the storms are coming. All of a sudden, at 3:30, boom, you feel the entire house shake. And Henry will go from a deep sleep, a deep, restful, peaceful sleep, to this weird, robotic other personality. His body stiffens. His muscles are just like, they're like stone. They're so tight. He walks robotically around the bed. His eyes are wild and he convulses. His body is just trembling and he won't be consoled. You can't pet him. You can't put him under the covers. You can't take him to a certain room. You can't turn the lights on. We try not to dote on him too much, right? You don't want to reinforce any negative type behavior. But at the same time, we want to make sure that he isn't in a place where he feels unsafe. Nothing works. Nothing works. I finally talked to the veterinarian about it. This is a few months back. And the vet says some dogs just have such extreme anxiety that the thunder shirt isn't enough. You know, the dark room, the warm blanket, the whatever it is you're doing is not going to be enough. You're going to have to implement some kind of a chemical change. And so my dog has been taking Xanax. For fear. And you know what? That shit works. I mean, he still has anxiety. But instead of, well, you know, here's a scenario. We're in the living room. A storm comes through. There's a clap of thunder outside. Boom. And he immediately becomes aware, no matter how loud the music is up or whatever else we're trying to do to distract him. He realizes, oh, shit, there's a storm outside. And instead of going robotic and violently convulsing and just sort of walking from corner to corner to corner to corner and exhausting himself with all this fear, he just kind of looks around and just kind of says, hey, what's that? What's going on? What's the deal? You know, is there something out there? So he's, you know, he's not totally cured, but he doesn't leave us mentally. And I'm a believer. I've told a few people that we medicate our dog for storms, and they're like, oh, are you sure that's a good thing? Giving your dog prescription medications for storms, that just sounds like a recipe for disaster. And I used to be that person. So anyway, I've been thinking about that because we're talking about, you know, the things that scare us. I've got a dog who is he's afraid of about everything, but storms are his gold standard for phobia. Now, when we talk about phobias tonight, I would not necessarily recommend that you go out and get yourself Xanax to cope with whatever it is. You know, there are probably some other solutions we need to look at. But it just breaks my heart, you know. So anyway, he's here in my lap as I do the radio show tonight. And it was on my mind. We were talking about fear and what does fear do for us? What does it do to harm us? And again, we're going to talk to Dr. Carolyn Rodriguez of Stanford University just a little later on in the show. She does a lot of work with fear and phobics. And we're going to get into sort of what it's all about. So while we're having some Halloween fun over the next couple of weeks, we'll get a chance to increase our knowledge and educate ourselves just a little bit, and perhaps even provide some resources for those people who do struggle with some serious phobias. I was going through the list prepping the show tonight, and there's some wild ones, hugely interesting ones. So your emails, your social media posts, your phone calls will constitute the bulk of the broadcast, plus our interview with Dr. Rodriguez. And we'll get into the material submitted by our guest and listeners here in just a second. We all remember the famous Franklin D. Roosevelt quote, right? The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, which is just total bullshit. I'm sorry. There's a lot of stuff out there that isn't fear that should be feared. I'm just saying. Hunter S. Thompson, you know, the gonzo journalist, said once, there is no such thing as paranoia. Your worst fears can come true at any moment. Of course, he was a real character. Plato had once said about fear, we can easily forgive a child who is afraid of the dark. The real tragedy of life is when men are afraid of the light. H.P. Lovecraft once said, the oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. Mark Twain once said, courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not absence of fear. Bertrand Russell, always quotable, once said this, fear is the main source of superstition and one of the main sources of cruelty. To conquer fear is the beginning of wisdom. Conquering fear, as we will see tonight, is often very, very difficult, but not impossible. Our first phobia was submitted by Andrew. Andrew said, I have a phobia. It's sitting with my back to the door in public places. You know, Natalie does that. We go into a restaurant. She will always take the seat where she can see the door, or she's at least not facing the wall. And she says that is a purposeful thing. It actually makes her feel more comfortable. I know another guy, he's into security, home security, and he's totally situational. When he walks into any place, he looks around, he knows where the exits are, he knows where the free spaces are, he knows what seats face where the mirrors in the room. He's totally, I don't know if it's overkill or what, but he's very cognizant of those types of things. Diego said, frogs and tiny lizards freak me out. Kirsten said, I get claustrophobic wearing turtlenecks or jackets or coats around my neck. Legitimate panic attack mode. Kirsten, you are in for a long winter. Is it the sensation of something touching the skin of your neck, or do you feel you're suffocating? Are you being choked in some way, or is it just, what's that about? That's interesting. Amy said, I'm afraid to put my hand in the garbage disposal because it might get chewed off. Also, if I have to open the washer lid, the barrel has to have been stopped for at least 10 seconds because I am afraid of my arm being ripped off at the shoulder. Tim sent a message and he said, I'm scared of bridges. Bridges, the bridges you drive over in your car and you walk over with your feet. Bridges. This is a thing. It's called Jeffreyophobia. There was an NBC News article that was posted a few years ago on it. The article that I found online was titled, Jeffreyophobics Fear Crossing That Bridge When They Come to It. And here's just a snippet of the article. It says this, for some, the mere thought of or anticipation of bridges brings on panic attack. Their hearts race and palms sweat, and they may also have trouble breathing and feel lightheaded. If driving, their hands death grip the steering wheel. They worry about losing control of the car and veering off the bridge, or becoming so freaked out that they stop traffic with no shoulder of the road to pull into. Jeffreyophobes are not worried about the bridge collapsing. They're worried about themselves collapsing, says Jean Ratner, a social worker who directs the Center for Travel Anxiety in Bethesda, Maryland. There's a Center for Travel Anxiety? She says a bridge phobia may stem from a fear of heights, and what's at the root of the problem is being scared of having a panic attack and not being able to manage it. This anxiety disorder usually has a sudden onset and tends to strike extremely good drivers, suggests Ratner. It often catches a person by surprise because this was someone who previously had no trouble crossing bridges. Then one day, a panicky feeling occurs on a tall bridge, typically on the first half of it as the car is climbing up the arch. Both the length and the height of the bridge can freak out sufferers who may drive miles out of the way to find an alternative route or make excuses for their travel-related anxieties. A dread of bridges is more likely when the person is doing the driving, but may also occur as a passenger. Interesting stuff. Let's go to the phones. Area code 214. You're on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. Who's this?
Hi, this is Jessica.
Jessica, we're talking about the things that scare us. Do you have a rational or irrational fear?
I have a very irrational fear. I am afraid of mascots.
You're afraid of mascots, like a sports mascot?
I'm mostly around sports mascots, but throw Mickey Mouse in there, Minnie Mouse, people that dress up in costume characters. I don't like them. I run away from them. I have a fear of them. I do not like them at all.
What happened to you? What, mom and dad took you to Disney World and something went horribly awry? What happened?
It's funny. I actually had this conversation with my mom earlier this week. I have pictures of me as a little kid, even like hugging Pluto and being around Minnie Mouse. So it was nothing that happened when I was a little kid. My first experience when I realized this was a problem for me was in college. I was interning with this company, and the boss was a really nice guy. He took the entire team out to a Phillies game. And we were in our little box seats or whatever, and the Philly fanatic came to our section, and I happened to be on the aisle seat. And he came up to me, and I freaked out. And I was basically crawling over my coworkers to get as far away from this thing as I possibly could. So
hang on, Jessica.
That's where I realized I have
Philly,
a problem with them.
Philly fanatic. F-A, is it like fanatic? Oh, I see. It came out fanatic. P-H-A-N-A-T-I-C. I just want to get a picture of this. Oh, my God.
He is scary. He is a scary thing. He's not normal.
What is it? He's green. He's got a blunt nose thing that makes him look like Hubert. He's terrifying.
He is terrifying. So I thought it was strange. My friends made fun of me for it, but whatever. Another baseball game, Mr. Met came up to my group of friends. My heart started beating, pounding, whatever. I walked away from it, couldn't stand to be nearby him. I'm at Disneyland. I see Mickey Mouse like 20 feet from me. I need to walk away. It's something about the big heads, the blank stares, the empty gestures. It's freaky to me.
Mr. Met, I don't know much about baseball. I don't follow baseball. He's a little scary too. I mean, I see what you're talking about. In the right context, No, Halloween night, if he comes to knock on your door, it's a movie.
My friends joke. They're like, if we show up as like a costume character, like normal costumes are fine. You could dress up as Batman, Captain America. You could show up at my door. That's okay. You show up to my door kind of dressed like Mickey Mouse. I don't know how I will react to you.
Wow. Okay. Well, helpful safety tip. If you show up to Jessica's place.
Just a warning.
She will wig if you do this. That's actually a really interesting and very entertaining phobia. Well, I hope you have a happy Halloween, Jessica. Thanks for sharing this little piece of yourself on the radio.
Sure. Thank you.
Wes said those tubes of cinnamon rolls that always seem to blow up when you least expect it. Yes, those are terrifying. Those cylindrical canisters where they have the cinnamon roll dough inside and you're supposed to tear the paper off outside. And then without warning, poof, the entire thing just kind of pops open. There's something terrifying about that. Monica said, driving up steep hills, basically all of San Francisco, Lombard Street. Yeah, that'll jack you up. Sheila said, I'm completely terrified of earthworms. It's probably one of the least rational fears ever. Because, you know, they're just worms. But I have a very visceral reaction when I see them. When I was 9, one of my brother's friends dropped a container of night crawlers down the back of my shirt, and I just can't handle them now. Area code 828, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. Who's this?
My name's Susan.
Susan, are you ready for Halloween?
I'm always ready for Halloween. It's a great holiday.
Do you enjoy being scared?
Yeah, sometimes. I like suspense. Like movies, I like suspense. I don't like gore. I like suspense.
Well, there's a big difference there. Gore is easy. Anybody can pour on the blood. But to really get inside somebody's skull, get them all freaked out.
Exactly.
We're talking about fears and phobias today. What fear or phobia do you have?
Well, I have a slight little phobia about ticks. I mean, if I get one on me, I totally panic. I can't. I'm a pet sitter, and yet I can't pull ticks off of animals because I can't stand them.
I totally understand ticks. There's something about their little legs, the way the legs come off the big bodies, and they and the idea that they're boring their head in under the skin. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Yeah.
Where did this phobia come from? I mean, is it just the look of the tick, or was it something else?
Well, it probably originally stems from an incident when I was about 6. I went camping with my dad and one of my brothers, who actually was his stepson, but this was after my parents were divorced and my dad would take me out on weekends, and he'd sometimes take my brother with us, and we used to argue, and I got a tick in my ear at this camping trip is what it was, and we were sitting there eating and I started screaming, and my dad thought my brother was picking on me, so he was yelling at him, and
hold on. You had a tick on your ear, or you had a tick
in my ear?
Inside.
Yes, I was screaming and they didn't know what was wrong with me, and I don't know how he figured out or something, but yeah, it actually went down in my ear. At the time, I'm guessing it was he could still see it, but it was down in the ear canal. He thought my brother had hit me or something, so he was yelling at my brother, but when they figured out I was still screaming, he took me to the hospital, and when the doctor looked in my ear in the emergency room, the tick was actually sitting on top of my eardrum when I got there. Yeah, exactly. He was afraid to, you know, go down in there to try to get it because any sudden movement or something, he could puncture my eardrum. And so the solution the doctor came up with was to shine a light in my ear and let the tick crawl up out towards light. And so I vaguely remember a lot of people having to hold me down while I laid there was screaming because you could hear this thing crawling up out of my ear. So that he could get it.
Ticks are attracted to light. He would disengage and come toward the light.
It wasn't actually bit down into, because if it had been, it would have been hooked to my eardrum. But I guess it's attracted to light just like any other bug. It seems like it wouldn't be, but that's how he got it. It came up towards light and I guess when it got far enough up there, he managed to get it out. But
yeah, Susan, I think it's a reasonable assumption that this is where your phobia about ticks has come from. Yes.
Maybe it's not an Maybe it's not an irrational fear.
I don't think it's irrational at all. It's what a terrifying story. You're six years old. There's a tick this close to embedding his head inside your eardrum.
And it's just that sound. Like I said, I have vague memories of it. Just I mean, they had to hold me down because I can imagine. You can imagine the sound of it just crawling up out of your ear because you can hear every little movement of the legs and stuff. And yeah.
Well, if I was a screenwriter for horror films in Hollywood, I would be taking a copious amount of notes right now because
there's probably been something out there close to that at some point.
There is. I think there's a monster flick called Tick or Ticks or something. I'm sure somebody, sci-fi certainly
has, but I've heard of it.
has blended a tick with some other creature, combined them and already made the film. But it's, well, thanks for sharing your fear. I hope you and yours have a very happy Halloween. Okay, Susan?
Oh, no problem. You too.
Elizabeth said she has a fear or phobia of escalators and elevators. Well, I hesitate to tell you this story, Elizabeth. Statistically, you're safe. This is probably much like flying, isn't it? Like the crash really is the anomaly, the freak accident. It's certainly not the norm, nothing that we should be concerned about in everyday life. But this story actually happened, reported July 29th on CNN. A 31-year-old mother going up the escalator at AZG Mall in central China. She had her young son in tow. As she steps onto the top panel, this metal panel beyond the first step of the escalator, the panel gives way and she disappears. She falls in. She disappears into this mechanism of the escalator completely, tossing her young son forward. She pushes him out of the way and she goes down. After a 4-hour rescue operation, they had to cut the freaking escalator apart just to find her. It was revealed that she'd been killed. She'd essentially been sucked into an escalator and crushed. And for telling that story on the radio show tonight, Elizabeth, I hope you will find a place in your heart to forgive me. Dan said he's afraid of Donald Trump. Dan, that's a totally justifiable fear. Amanda, the Achilles tendon. People touching it, injuring it, severing it. Amanda, never, ever, on any occasion, for any reason, ever, ever watch the movie Hostel. Okay? Helpful tip for you. Never watch Hostel. Neil said having blood drawn is a real fear. Terry's afraid of MRI machines. I guess this is common. People who work in the healthcare profession, they have patients that go in there and some sort of claustrophobia, maybe some other things come into play. Many of them panic and crawl out during the scan. Some of them screaming. I guess this is a thing. Jeff said he's afraid of sinkholes. Oh, yeah. I totally get this one, too, Jeff. They're also known as, and I had not heard this term before, swallow holes, a depression or hole in the ground caused by some form of collapse in the surface layer. They can vary in size. They can be about a meter across to over 600 meters. There's a place in Egypt called the Blue Hole. It's 130 meters deep. Many free divers and scuba divers have died just trying to explore it. There's the, I'm sure I'm saying it wrong, the Pozzo del Mero near Rome, about 400 meters deep. There's the Devil Well of Greece. It's killed 4 divers already, 115 feet deep, about 500 feet across. What about this true story from the town of Sefner, Florida? This is from 2 years ago, February 2013. Jeff Bush turned in for the night. He's in bed. And under his bed, a sinkhole opened up. And he screamed for help from his brother, Jeremy, who ran into the room to discover that his brother and all of the furnishings in the room, everything in the bedroom, was gone. It had sunk into the ground. And Jeff's body was never recovered. Just a terrible story. You can see and run from a tornado. Perhaps you can even run from a tsunami wave Well, what do you do when at any moment the very ground beneath you may disappear and you become swallowed by the earth itself? That is terrifying. Karen says she hates putting a tight shirt or long dress over her head for more than a second or two. If it's on for more than a second, covering her face, her eyes, she anxiously wants to just rip the thing just to get free. Tim said he's been clinically diagnosed with emetophobia. I hope I'm saying that right. E-M-E-T-O-P-H-O-B-I-A. Emetophobia, the fear of vomiting. Eric said, balloons popping. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's nasty. Azrael said this, you'll probably get a laugh out of this, but I have a fear of cute things. My logic behind this is that the scariest things are the ones that are the most deceptively harmless. If something seems harmless to me, in the back of my mind, I have the voice saying, what if this is just a facade? What if it is subversive? And above all else, what happens when your back is turned? So what are we talking about, Azrael? We're talking about like Teletubbies and stuff? You know, puppies and kittens, those types of things? Kathy said, scraping my teeth on popsicle sticks is a fear. Curtis is afraid of funeral homes. Stephen said, the funeral home converted into a Burger King. Now, hang on just a second. I saw this and I searched for the story, Stephen. I couldn't find the Burger King that you are referencing. A funeral home converted into a Burger King. I could not find. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm saying my Google search was futile. However, when I was searching, I stumbled across this story from back in January of 2013 about David S. Kime, K-I-M-E, of York, Pennsylvania, a man who loved life and apparently loved him some Burger King. He died at the age of 88. So his love of fast food apparently did not shorten his lifespan in any significant way. And as a tribute to this guy, the funeral procession took a detour through the Burger King drive-thru at the corner of Route 30 and Pennsylvania Avenue. And everybody in the procession ordered David's favorite sandwich, which was the Whopper Jr. The chapel gave advance notice to this particular Burger King so they could have the burgers prepared and ready. And as he was driven to his final resting place, David Kime remained a Burger King buff to and through the very end. Now that is how you send somebody off in style, people. All right, we've been talking quite a bit about fears and the phobias we have. Let's talk about the science of fear just a little bit, since it is, after all, the title of our broadcast. My special guest, who I'm so privileged to have, is Dr. Carolyn Rodriguez. Dr. Rodriguez is a Harvard graduate and an assistant professor at Stanford University, director of Rodriguez Lab. She had authored an article published a couple of years ago in the Huffington Post called Outsmart Your Brain, Use the Science of Fear to Tackle Your Biggest Challenge. And once I saw the article, I thought she'd be great for the broadcast today, and she's been kind enough to join me. Dr. Rodriguez, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
I stumbled across your writings about fear, kind of the science of fear, and I became instantly fascinated. But first, I want to start with kind of your background. What do you do at Stanford?
At Stanford, I'm the director of the Rodriguez Lab, and what we look at is trying to develop new treatments for individuals with obsessive compulsive disorder and hoarding disorder. I have a real interest in how the brain develops anxiety disorders and what's the best way to treat them. And obsessive compulsive disorder and hoarding disorder are two of those types of anxiety disorders.
Like, I have to do this or else something will happen kind of a thing, or what?
Right. Well, the field is actually shifting in terms of the exact definition of what's an anxiety disorder and not. But in obsessive compulsive disorder, what we do know is that individuals have these intrusive thoughts and it causes them a lot of anxiety, and they have to do these kind of compulsive or repetitive behaviors to decrease that anxiety.
If you don't flip the light switch off 25 times or whatever, I have a fear something bad will happen.
Exactly. So some individuals have a fear that will cause a fire, you know, if they leave the lights on. For some, it can be something a little bit more called magical thinking, where if they don't arrange things in a symmetrical way, then their mother might die.
And where do these come from? They just manufacture these consequences?
Yes. So that's why we need more research into the causes of obsessive compulsive disorder. We don't know, but we do know that there are circuits in the brain, in the front part of the brain and in the middle, that can influence this kind of loop, like the sort of playback of these thoughts that happen over and over.
Yeah, forgive my overly simplistic questions. Yeah. I'm sure we're talking about very deep and complex issues. And I just say, why? You know, why and how? Those are my favorite questions, you know.
Yeah, they're great questions. And I think these are topics of active research. And a lot of what we do is trying to find new medications that help folks with different kinds of anxiety disorders. And also at the same time, try to understand what is the basis in the brain for these kinds of disorders.
It is the season of the year, of course, for fear as we head toward Halloween, which is really the reason we are speaking. Are you a fan? Do you enjoy Halloween, Dr. Rodriguez?
Yes, I love Halloween. It's a wonderful, wonderful time of year.
So let's talk about fear. Rational fears are often healthy, right? They keep us safe. They keep us alive. You want to address a healthy fear of something for us?
Definitely. So fear is like a natural alarm bell in your body, and it's important and necessary to keep us safe from threats. So fear helps us run away from a bear or stay away from the ledge of a skyscraper, for example. And fear is unpleasant emotion. And during a threat, what typically happens is that part of the brain called the amygdala, it's this, basically this teardrop shape of cells located inside of our brain, can set off this chain reaction that prepares us to respond. So the amygdala really tells other parts of the brain and the body to secrete these chemical messengers that make us more alert and ready to respond. And these messengers increase our heart rate, blood flow to our muscles. This is what gets us ready for a confrontation or running away, otherwise known as fight or flight response. And our brain can also protect us from pain if under attack by releasing messengers called opioids. And these are things that numb pain and make us feel like life is just fine. Once the threat is passed, then our brain quickly and powerfully records all the details of the event and helps us be safe the next time. And it helps do this by boosting the brain cell connections that associate with specific threat and danger.
There's these videos on YouTube of people who climb to the top of these tall, tall skyscrapers. And they have GoPro cameras mounted to their helmets. And without any sort of tether, they just walk the beams and the wind's blowing and they seem completely unconcerned.
Right.
And I look at them, and if it was me, I would be down on all fours, probably actually chest down to the roof of whatever building it was. I would be clutching. I would be unable to breathe. I would be frozen with fear. What's the difference between them and me? Why is it an adrenaline rush for them and an episode of just terror for me?
Yes, definitely. Well, I completely empathize. That is a very scary situation. I would feel the same way. And, you know, it's a wonderful question. I would love to be able to know what's protective, what helps people get over their fears like that. And what we know is that it's a combination of genetics and environment. So for some people, you know, just like we have different kinds of eye color or hair color, some people have this type of fear machinery that helps them be able to control better their response to fear. And some people are just born where it's a lot more difficult and a lot more challenging.
It's like Jeb Corliss who puts on the bat suit and jumps off the cliff and flies all the way down. It's like he needs to have this in his life or else he just doesn't feel like he's truly living. And I can get the same rush with, you know, some MythBusters and a cup of coffee. You know, it's just weird.
Right. It's true. Yeah, people are wired in different ways, but it's also part of your environment, too. Let's say you come from a family of daredevils, and it's just from a very early age you've been exposed and actually taught in a methodical way how to face your fears. This can actually change the fear circuitry or machinery that you have to make you more resistant to being negatively impacted by fear.
So we've established rational fears can help us, right? It's healthy for me to have a fear in some instance of a dangerous animal or a fear of walking into traffic, those types of things. But what about irrational fears? Mm-hmm. Someone has a fear of the monster in the closet or spiders or something else. Can you speak to irrational fears, the weird things, the idiosyncrasies we have when it comes to fear that we just think, well, I shouldn't be afraid, but I really am?
So like we were talking about, the body has this natural way of responding to fear, but sometimes this process can go awry, and some people can feel all the physical feelings of the fight or flight response, but they have an exaggerated response. It actually causes impairment. That's really where the line is crossed between something that most people would be afraid of from day to day and people that actually go on to suffer from an anxiety disorder of some type. Some people develop phobias. Phobias are very common. Over their lifetimes, 11% of people will have a phobia. And in these situations, even, thinking about a particular object or approaching it will result in fear that is unreasonable and excessive. So, for example, let's take a snake or even a spider. Any of us would feel a little bit like the hair stand up on the back of our neck if a spider is crawling on their arm. But people suffering from something like arachnophobia, the fear of spiders, are really physically and psychologically impaired by it. They can't function.
I'm doing a presentation around the country that talks about a study that came out of the University of California's Department of Psychology, where they have a theory that just the sight of a snake, a legless reptile, triggers an automatic fear response in the primate brain. And their theory is that this is a holdover from our deep ancestry when venomous snakes posed a significant threat to our survival. And it's possibly one of the reasons that higher primates have better eyesight and larger brains. The idea is that snakes may have made us smarter or more acute in this way. And I thought that was very interesting.
Fear is something that is a wonderful evolutionary thing for all of us. If we didn't have fear, we would, be running into the face of danger, and as a species in society, we wouldn't evolve. And one of the things too is that's why it's important to have people who are brave and also people who are shy as well. Because brave people sort of, in terms of society, go out into the world and discover new areas, new terrains, and individuals who are a little bit more shy or a little bit more susceptible to fear can rein those folks back. And so you don't have all these people doing this skydiving or cliff diving or things where they might put their lives into danger and have some core of society that really is more moderate in their exploratory tendencies.
So you see it as a societal benefit. You've got those people who are going to go out and push the edge of the envelope as far as they can. And then another ilk of people back here who are going, hey, wait a minute. You might want to use discretion, but everybody benefits because you might find, a few inches past the edge that we didn't realize were there before, that kind of thing?
That's exactly right. And often I talk to families where they are worried, my son or daughter is very shy, how are they going to do? And actually, this is a wonderful trait and as wonderful and as necessary and as needed as somebody who's extroverted and out there.
Talking here with Dr. Carolyn Rodriguez of Stanford University, I'm fascinated by the scary movie The Haunted House, a place where we know in our logical brain, if that's a thing, and you can correct me, Dr. Rodriguez, if I'm wrong, but we know factually that we're not in danger. If you go into Universal Studios Haunted House, whatever it's called, and you know you're about to have the pants scared off of you, you also know logically that you are not in danger. Is there something to that? Like, I want to be scared, but not too much.
That's true. Well, what's interesting is that along with all of these chemical messengers that make your heart race and make the hair stand on the back of your neck, it also secretes something called opioids that are pleasureful and actually make you feel good. And so part of what happens when you go to a scary house is that you feel your muscles tense. You feel really anxious. You might even feel as if you're going to die from being so anxious. But then at the end, when the scare comes, there's a release. And you end up leaving the haunted house feeling good and happy and joking around. And there's a little bit of a buzz, a little bit of pleasureful feeling. And that's what keeps us coming back to haunted houses and thrill rides and scary movies.
Opioids. I need to get me some of those. How do I? You're a doctor. Can you score me some? I'd like to feel some of that. You know, it's funny because
it's natural. It's a natural opioid. So actually, doing something that scares you a little bit is actually just great for your brain. So, for example, a couple years ago, I was nervous and scared to learn how to swim, and I enrolled in adult swimming classes. And you know, again, you sort of feel the like heart racing. I would look at the pool and feel a little bit dizzy. But little by little, challenging yourself in those ways, you can get a natural opioid rush or endorphin rush, and it actually helps you associate the sort of fearful thing, like being scared of drowning, with something pleasurable, like, you know, I can do it. I can do these strokes, and I am going to be able to swim. So you can do it yourself.
So if it is important for us to occasionally face our fears, and you deal with people a lot who need to break through some kind of wall, they need to get to a point where they're not just in a debilitating, paralyzing fear, but they can participate in the world around them. Do you get them to quote unquote face their fears? You know, if they have a fear of spiders, do you introduce them to the spiders in some way? If they have a fear of the outdoors, do you walk them one step at a time? How do you approach facing your fears?
That's exactly right. So for individuals where they have anxiety disorders or their fear circuitry is gone awry in these different ways that we've been talking about, there's something very specific. And there's been a lot of research in this area to try and help people face their fears with something called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And there's a part of cognitive behavioral therapy called exposure, in which individuals basically face their fears, making a list of the things from least feared to most feared. And they walk up this sort of like the rungs of a ladder with a coach, a therapist. And it can be really helpful to slowly desensitize you to those things that make you afraid. And that's actually how we treat people with certain kinds of anxiety disorder.
I'm trying to think of the things that scare me. I have this phobia about treading water. I used to be a scuba diver. Being under the water was fine. Treading water, being above and thinking there was something large below me, mm-hmm. that was always a phobia.
Right.
When I was a kid, it was the monster in the closet or under the bed. You know, country mm-hmm. music. I mean, I've got several.
Country music, that's funny.
What scares you, Dr. Rodriguez? Do you have anything that you would admit to that you think, you know, I still kind of carry this with me?
For me, fear of drowning is the number one fear that I have. And being able to face the fear and be able to take these adult swimming classes 2 years ago really helped. But still, the sight of open water, I still have thoughts like, oh, can I remember how to swim? You know, what if the current is strong? So I think all of us have different kinds of fears throughout our lives, and they can sort of wax and wane. And by practicing and facing your fears, you can actually make them get a little bit better.
It's interesting. You are aware of the nuts and bolts in many ways, the nuts and bolts of fear, and yet you still have that very human reaction to the idea of going into or near water. Mm-hmm. Do you have that conversation in your head? You know, I'm a doctor. I do this for a living. I know this stuff. I shouldn't feel this way, but I still do. Does that go on?
Yes. Were you there when I was having my swim classes? That's exactly right. So, you know, I just, you know, would get to the edge and feel anxiety and pull back. And that's why it's really important to see a professional. So I went to a professional swim coach who knows how to teach things like, well, first, why don't you just sit down with me here and put your foot in the water, and then you kind of get used to it. You know, nothing bad is going to happen if you put your foot in the water. And similarly, when you go and see a professional therapist, they can start with you in a place to try and conquer and face your fears that's reasonable, and they'll help you through it.
Well, that leads me, I think, to my final question, and you sort of half answered it, but I'm going to go a little deeper. I want the show here to bring benefit to people who might be dealing with fear mm-hmm. in perhaps an unhealthy way. Let's say that they have some sort of debilitating fear, or it's brought some real negativity into their lives. You said therapy, find a professional. Is there a course or a way to find someone who's not using, you know, chakras and shark cartilage and you know, non-scientific ways of handling it? Is there a resource you'd recommend for people who are trying to get over some kind of fear?
Definitely. There are professional organizations, and they have a lot of different kinds of resources. So the first step, I would say, is get information. And you can get that from the American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association. There's also the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, ADAA. These are great resources for finding out more about resources for different kinds of therapy, talk therapy, medications that can be helpful for you. So really, the first step is to educate yourself. For those people who have tried a lot of these things and it's been difficult to find help, I would say don't lose hope. There are a lot of great clinical research trials going on, and you can go to clinicaltrials.gov, and that has, you can actually do a search by the type of disorder. If you have obsessive compulsive disorder or hoarding or specific phobia, there's a lot of different kinds of research studies available where you can get access to experts who are doing the research in the areas right now.
So are you dressing up this year, or are you just going to answer the door when the doorbell rings?
Hopefully all of the above. I love Halloween, and I really enjoyed listening to your scary stories episode, particularly your ghost story. So it actually did make me scared. So good for you.
That is the best compliment you could give me. Dr. Carolyn Rodriguez, assistant professor at Stanford, director of the Rodriguez Lab. And thanks so much for your time, for your perspective on fear. And I hope you and yours have a happy Halloween, okay?
Thank you so much.
Do you know what sleep paralysis is? I caught a documentary on it just a few nights ago on Netflix, and I thought it would bear mention for the broadcast today. Sleep paralysis is essentially when someone is in a dream state, but their body is in a transitional stage between wake and sleep. So they're paralyzed, they can't move, and in many instances, they experience these terrifying hallucinations that they can't wake up from. Many of them say they can't breathe. It feels like they're being suffocated. I myself have this happen a couple times a year, much to the chagrin of my poor wife. I was talking to a theist on the radio a few years ago, and he was attempting to prove the supernatural by describing this phenomenon, sort of a blending of the natural and the supernatural world and demon activity and whatnot. And it didn't ring a bell with me at the time, but I had people in the comments section and in my own email inbox say what he's describing is just sleep paralysis. You should check it out. And so I did some digging, and it was like, oh my God, this couple of times a year, this very thing happens. I just didn't realize it was a thing. I didn't realize it had a name. So the documentary, The Nightmare, is on Netflix. It's directed by a guy named Rodney Asher. No big spoilers or anything here. I'm just talking in a general way about the film. And honestly, The Nightmare does a really good job of recreating the kind of surreal, paralyzed terror that one feels in sleep paralysis. You know, the reenactments are sometimes creepy. Sometimes they cross that line between creepy into just cheesy. You just go, oh, come on. You'd be self-conscious. You're trying way too hard. But there were a few times when they, you know, showed the dark figure in the room, and I just got goosebumps. I got the chills. It was genuinely scary. Scary because it is familiar. But I can't recommend the movie as a resource for understanding sleep paralysis, because the film isn't really interested in education about sleep paralysis. Not one scientist interviewed, not one physiologist, not one cognitive neuroscientist, not one sleep expert, not one. Not one person with any expertise in the functions of the brain. None of the subjects submitted for any documented sleep trials or sleep analysis. Nothing. Over and over and over and over and over. It's just these poor people relaying the stories of these horrible visions that they have many times every time they go to sleep. I mean, every time they drop off, they have to expect this to happen. And then they give their own subjective, non-scientific opinions about all the crazy shit that their brain had done the previous night. Over and over and over, it's just one dream after another, one terror after another. Yeah, we get it. After 45 minutes, I'm thinking, I understand what you're trying to say. It's scary. Where's the science? Where is the message here beyond it's scary? And unfortunately, that's all The Nightmare wants to do as a documentary. It just wants to try to creep you out. If I spend 90 minutes focused on a particular subject. I want to come away understanding more about the subject. Now, it might provide a couple of benefits. It might help people who've never experienced sleep paralysis understand what their friends are going through. I think that has merit. And it might remind those who've been through it that they're not alone, and it's a thing. It's not uncommon. They're not an isolated case. You are not alone. I mean, the film might provide that benefit for them. Mostly, it was just people talking about what freaked them out. One lady said that she was convinced that the figures in her dreams were demons. Her solution was to just say the name of Jesus. The demon went away, and then she converted to Christianity. You know, oh, okay, thanks. Thanks for that. Have you read any more about sleep paralysis? No, no. Have you seen the anecdotes of other people who experienced many of the same things you did? No, I'm not really interested in. Have you gotten into the science of sleep paralysis? No, you know, it's in the past. I just, you know, Jesus. Oh, come on. I got the how. I wanted the why. So, for a moment here on the radio, allow me to provide a few of the explanations that the film does not. And you can find this info in lots of various resources like the American Academy of Sleep Medicine and others, okay? Now, I must say, the science on sleep paralysis is still developing. A lot of hypotheses flying around out there. But this is the general consensus of experts out there. And if you come across another explanation by someone who is a neurologist or a sleep analyst or someone who knows what they're talking about, it doesn't mean that opinion doesn't have merit or weight. It just means that it wasn't here in my research on the mainstream causes or the mainstream explanations for sleep paralysis, okay? Sleep paralysis that occurs a lot is known as parasomnia. A parasomnia involves undesired events that come along with sleep, essentially at key points when you're falling asleep and or when you're waking up. Now, normally, your brain causes your muscles to relax and be still as you sleep. Your brain is wired at these times for deep stage 4 REM sleep, a place where it would normally disengage the body from bodily action. Otherwise, you would be physically acting out all your dreams, right? If you dreamed you were running, your body would be physically running. So the brain disengages. This stage is called atonia. And sleep paralysis seems to happen when atonia occurs while you are, at least partially, awake. So you're semi-conscious, or at the very least, you're not in a REM sleep state, but your brain keeps you partially or completely frozen in place as if you were. It's thought that the breathing patterns of REM sleep might actually bring about or enhance that feeling of suffocation, where the attempt to breathe resists or seems to resist. It results for many people in the sensation that there's a weight resting on their chest, pushing the air out of their lungs, even if they're actually breathing normally. Sleep paralysis is often associated with terrifying visions, the feeling of a presence next to you, dark figures, and strange apparitions. A neurological interpretation of the intense terror and panic brought about by the intruder visions might be it's a product of the midbrain. As the brain triggers an emergency response, it senses you're paralyzed, and it feels vulnerable to attack. And the helplessness heightens that feeling, not just of fear, but of all the senses. And that may explain why people's memories of sleep paralysis events have such detail. The brain is just ramped up and amped up. All pistons are firing. Sleep paralysis divided into two major classifications. There's isolated sleep paralysis, or ISP, and recurrent isolated sleep paralysis, RISP. Recurrent means it's chronic. And for RISP sufferers, the episodes can last for up to an hour or even longer. If you have chronic sleep paralysis, you're also much more likely to perceive an out-of-body experience. In fact, it's suspected many people who claim to have been abducted by aliens, we've heard those stories, right? Actually, they probably had a sleep paralysis episode, and the hallucination was so real, so tangible to them, the abductees were convinced that it actually happened. The isolated sleep paralysis episodes, the ISPs, are usually much shorter, 1 to 2 minutes on average. And those are the ones associated with the feelings that there is an intruder or dark entity in the room with you. The dark entity or intruder visions are a common element of sleep paralysis here. People talk about this on every continent of the globe. Sleep paralysis is often really difficult to break free from. It usually has to end on its own, but from time to time you can make an intense effort to move. That might trigger the end of the episode, or when someone touches you or speaks to you. Sleep paralysis might also help to indicate that there's something else going on. Narcolepsy, sleep apnea, stress, reaction to medication, reaction to stimulants, fatigue, some kind of mental health disorder. It's more common in people who suffer from lack of sleep or they have a constantly shifting sleep schedule. Also, if you sleep in the supine position, which is on your back lying face up, you might be much more prone to this because that position makes it more likely the soft palate's going to collapse and obstruct the airway. And that takes us back to unfulfilling sleep patterns and that sensation of being unable to breathe when sleep paralysis strikes. Again, for me, it's probably a twice-a-year thing. I mean, it's not anything I ever worry about going to bed. It just happens probably a couple times a year. It's almost always the same scenario. I'm lying in my bed, on my back, face up, middle of the night, and I'm just paralyzed. I can't move anything. My head, my arms, my legs, my fingers, my toes. At first, I don't see any presence in the room, but I can feel a presence in the room. And everything just feels sinister. And then something finally drifts into my eye line, right? Something vaguely human. It's tall, it is standing, and it's like someone painted something from head to toe in black. My eyes won't focus on it. It's always blurry, but I can tell it's just absolutely black, tall, and looming right over me. And in the dream, I feel immediate panic because I'm helpless to move. I cannot do anything about it, and I feel like I'm suffocating, and the presence above me and right next to me just feels evil. Now, even when I was a devout Christian, I didn't take the leap and say that this is a demon or the devil, but I know a shit ton of people who make this leap. It's interesting that sleep paralysis was once considered demonic, as the incubi would sit upon your chest. In fact, the old English word for incubi was mare. So the mare in nightmare actually referred to this demon, the demon who would come at night to terrorize you and suffocate you. That's where we get the word nightmare. Last thing, real fast. If you do suffer from sleep paralysis and it's chronic and it's genuinely affecting your life, don't give up hope. Over 6% of people have experienced this phenomenon at least once in their lives. And there are a lot of stories of people who have managed to overcome some promising solutions out there, ranging from the adjustment of sleeping habits to the reduction of stress to the possible effectiveness of prescribed drugs for the more serious cases. And obviously, these conversations start with your physician and or a sleep specialist. And to the producers of The Nightmare, I just covered more actual data about sleep paralysis in a few minutes than you guys did in 90. I'm just saying. I just want it on the record, okay? Here's an example of someone who overcame. Talk about facing your fear. Her name is Amanda. She sent me an email. She said, "My fear has always been clowns." Now, we get a lot of clowns every time we talk about fear. People say clowns, clowns are scary. For me, it started with Poltergeist, 1982. Clowns, yeah. Amanda said, "The happier, the scarier. I figure if they show up looking all evil in the first place, you know what to expect, but the happy ones scare the hell out of me. I've had a recurring nightmare since I was about 5. And it's about a zombie midget clown who is dingy green and resembles the leprechaun from the movies. Oh, the horror movies, okay? He's the type of monster that manifests when you think of him. So no matter what, you're kind of always thinking about him. It's like when someone says, don't think about a pink horse. Well, now you're thinking about a black horse trying not to think of a pink one, which means the pink one is still on your mind. Did that make sense? Anyway, so when you think of him, he, poof, is there. He would chase me all over the house, and I would run from him. He always caught up to me, and he chops off my left ear. I then run to the mirror to look, and the reflection is me at whatever age I am having the dream. So then I was 5. Now if I have the dream, I'm 30. Same dream, same everything except me in the mirror. I also hate having my ears touched. I'll bet it stems from this dream. How I got over it, then and now I've always loved Halloween and horror. So one Halloween, I mentioned I wanted to maybe be a terrifying clown. Everyone said I'd never be able to do it. The one thing you don't do to me is tell me I can't. So I dressed up as a super terrifying clown. And since then, I'm not as phobic about them. In fact, it's reversed to a fascination of the creepy clowns, and I love pictures of them, the scarier the better. But those damn happy ones, I still don't trust. I have attached a photo of my first clown costume. I know the radio audience cannot see it. Let me assure you, it is terrifying. Amanda, if you dressed up as this, score. Congratulations. Well done. You've overcome something, and now you're probably somebody else's nightmare. If I can quickly sort of describe what I'm looking at, it's a large tuft of green hair sort of bobbed on each side. The hair has a metallic sort of a tinsel look to it, almost like fishing wire that's been bunched all together. It's a lime green. White makeup on the face except for green around the eyes and then dark black right around the actual eyeballs themselves. Very long black eyelashes. There are black lines coming down the standard clown lines of the white face. A red nose. Black lips. The teeth are all rotted out. The chin has been elongated, so where the normal rounding of a human chin would happen, this is almost like the Joker on crack. The chin goes way, way down, so you've got this very long white face with a gleefully fierce, predatory stare on it. And of course, the head is attached to this multicolored, very happy-looking clown suit. So it's this weird mix of sensations, the colors that normally would make you feel happy and good if you saw a clown at the circus or at the fair. Well, on top of that suit, you see just a horrifying face that looks as if it's about to devour you whole. Amanda, congratulations on conquering at least partially your phobia, and well played. Lori sent a message about how she'd overcome her fear. She said this: when I first started going through medical assisting training, I was scared of watching anyone draw my blood. I could draw on other people, but knowing the needle was going into my arm was too much for me. I basically did a mental meditation where I told myself I was watching a movie or that it was someone else's arm, and it went away over a week or so. Now I have no problems. Not to say I want to see it, but if I do, I won't get worked up anymore. Lori, thanks for the message. Area code 217, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. Who's this?
Hi, this is Deb.
We're talking about fears and phobias today. What's your fear and or phobia?
Mine is rather odd. It's a fear of taxidermed animals, animals that used to be alive and now are dead and have been stuffed and they're on display.
So did you have an encounter with one when you were a kid or something? What happened?
Did I ever? My father, well, I'm 58 years old, so this is an old phobia. My father was a biology teacher, and went to be a biology professor, a botany professor at a university. But when I was about 5 years old, this man was a wonderful man, but he had a very childish streak in him. He took me to the Museum of Natural History in Chicago, just a daddy and daughter day, which was marvelous. And most of it was great, except when we went through the reptile room, where all these dead stuffed coil snakes were behind glass. And he would sneak up behind me while I was fascinated looking at them and say, "It's going to get dead," and grab me from behind.
Oh.
And he did this enough times that by the end of that whole walk through that area, I was shaking like a leaf.
Scarred, psychologically scarred by your own father. It's a travesty.
By my own father. And he wasn't even an abusive man. He just didn't understand what he was doing to me. But it got to the point where years later, I still cannot sit in a room with a crouching anything. Or I even went and visited somebody who had a stuffed squirrel on the newel post of their staircase, and I had to leave.
Wait, you know somebody who stuffed a squirrel and displayed it in the house?
I live in the Bible Belt of Southern Illinois.
They probably ate the meat then, and then they stuffed the rest of him and put him on display.
I guess, yeah. This was a guy I had a date with one time, and all the way up the staircase, they were squirrels.
You go away. Wait, now, is it a blind date? Hi, I'm Deb. It's nice to meet you. Holy shit, you've got stuffed dead things watching me in the living room, or what?
It was the last date.
You've heard the story about that guy, the Dutch artist, Bart Janssen. His cat Orville was struck by a car and killed. And I guess he must have been really attached to the cat or had just a twisted sense of humor. And so he had the cat stuffed with legs outstretched, and he mounted propellers to the legs and turned his cat into a helicopter. Have you heard that story?
Oh, no.
Deb, there's video on YouTube. There's video of the flying dead cat copter on YouTube. So if you're baby stepping out of your phobia, maybe you can laugh as you're horrified and see both at the same time, okay?
Oh, no.
Maybe it is your worst nightmare. Know. You look out the window and there's a levitating cat copter staring you in the face. Well, I hope you and yours have a wonderful Halloween, and thanks for sharing your phobia on the radio, Deb.
Happy Halloween to you too, Seth.
Area code 570, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. Who's this?
Seth, this is Jason. How are you?
I'm well. Hope you're doing well. Thanks for being a part of the broadcast. What's your submission tonight? What phobia or fear do you have?
Well, I have a very bad fear of getting hit with a foul ball at a baseball game.
What does that stem from?
Well, it all started, my first baseball game that I ever was at was a church bus trip to Philadelphia Phillies game when I was years old. And, you know, they hand out the tickets, and you got these nosebleed seats in Veterans Stadium, which was one of those old, terrible, multi-purpose stadiums. And on the back of the ticket, there was this disclaimer that said, you know, Philadelphia Phillies and Major League Baseball are not responsible when fans get hit by flying objects. And it startled me a little bit as a 10-year-old kid. And then I'm sitting there watching the game, and I'm so grateful that we have a nosebleed seat, because there's no way that a ball is going to come up there. And a couple years later, I went to my second baseball game, which was at a minor league park in Reading, just little old Reading Municipal Stadium. And I realized that unless you're sitting behind the net, behind home plate, which we weren't, I could get knocked with a foul ball. And everyone that came over in our general direction, I just kind of winced and crouched and got into the fetal position and just got out of the way. And it was pretty intense for me, which was silly because everybody else was just wanting to reach out and catch it. And in the meantime, I'm just trying to get under the seat.
Man, my heart breaks for you, right? You're a boy wanting to go to the baseball game. That should be a positive experience. Instead, you're sitting up there with a crash helmet rocking back and forth. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. A couple years later, I was at another minor league game in Scranton-Wilkes-Barre, and I was there with my family, and we ended up having seats right on the first baseline, right above the dugout, in prime line drive territory. And at every single pitch, I was just... my heart was racing, my blood pressure was up, and I was never so happy to get out of a ballpark than when that game was over. So to this day, I always either sit behind home plate, behind that heading, or way, way out in the out.
I'd be curious to see how many other people, you know, when somebody tips a foul ball back and it goes up, especially when the midday sun is there and you lose sight of the ball with a glare. There has to have been some people out there who have been injured.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, there have been some problems this year, especially in Philadelphia. I don't know if it's the way the stadium is designed or the way the netting is designed, that the commissioner of Major League Baseball actually came to a press conference at a particular game, and later on during that game, someone in the stands was hit and injured with a foul ball.
It's supposed to be a positive experience. I'm trying to think of what the percentages are. There are tens and tens of thousands of people at a Major League Baseball game. What are the chances that I'm going to be the one who gets pegged? You know, that's the thing that's going through my... I'm doing the math, Jason.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's a great phobia. Be curious if anybody else shares this phobia. Does the foul ball freak you out at a baseball game? Just comment about it. I'd be curious to see that. My friend, thanks for sharing your story and your phobia on the radio. And it's very entertaining stuff, my friend.
All right, take care,
sir. Here's a fear story that just might give you pause. And like most scary stories, it's scary because this one happened in the real world. Have you ever heard of a phenomenon called intraoperative awareness? Well, let's say you're going to go in for surgery, like Jacinta Richmond did, for reconstructive surgery on her face, on her jaw. And so she was placed under general anesthesia. And sometime during the actual surgery, the invasive surgery on her face, Jacinta woke up. However, she was still under the influence of the muscle relaxers that had been part of the anesthetic. So even though she could feel sensation and she could hear every word the doctors were saying, and she could hear and feel the hammers and chisels and saws and everything as they removed pieces of jawbone, she was powerless to move, to even twitch, to indicate to anybody in the room that she was no longer really asleep. Intraoperative awareness. It affects a very, 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 very tiny percentage of people. And it has to be said that even those who do awaken during whatever procedure they're undergoing quite often can feel pressure, but they feel no pain. They're awake, but it's not a painful situation. But still, even a tiny number, right? Even a tiny percentage is still a percentage. It's still a number. It still could be you. That is scary. Claudia said, I'm terrified of sidewalk grates, especially the ones I can see deep below them. It's important to say I have skydived from 10,000 feet. So you jump out of a plane, but you're terrified of the sidewalk grate. There was a Seth, not me, another Seth, who said this. I had irrational fears throughout my life when I was a kid, and it was late. I always had to turn on every single light leading to the bathroom when I needed to go. Why? Because there was probably a monster that was hiding in the shadows to get me. As I got a little older, it was no longer scary monsters with big sharp teeth, but instead, a shower curtain. I knew that there was nobody behind it, but my mind thought otherwise, like someone has nothing else to do with their whole day but to hide behind my shower curtain of all places just so they can pop out at me and get me. No, not hide in a closet or another room that isn't used too often. That would be a bit more comfortable, but I think I'll hide behind this shower curtain and wait for Seth to take a shower, and then I'll jump out at him. You would think a serial killer or an evil clown could make better use of their time. Now there's another fear. My mind will always think up phobias I've had as a kid and incorporate them into new fears. You hate clowns and shower curtains, so it turns out that there's a sadistic clown hiding behind your shower curtain this morning waiting to kill you. Seth, thanks so much for that. A whole lot of people mentioned a fear of shower curtains or what's behind them or what's under the bed, right? Compelled to check constantly when they walk into the bathroom or whatever room they are in. These people are going to recoil in horror at this story, reported in March of this year by Hillary Hansen of the Huffington Post. Quote, do your friends, lovers, and family members mock you for your compulsion to check your home's every nook and cranny for intruders before you go to bed? A 61-year-old woman was simply looking for her cats when she reached under the bed at her Palm Springs, Florida home Tuesday night, the Sun Sentinel reports. Instead of her lovable fur balls or a couple of jingly toys, the woman, whose name has not been released, touched human skin, a police report obtained by the Sentinel has said. The man under the bed, who police later identified as a 25-year-old, fled the scene. He's accused of taking a gold anklet and a digital camera, and he's facing charges of burglary, grand theft, and resisting arrest. If this story isn't enough justification to double-check your living quarters every night, just close your eyes and think about the man who slept more than 8 hours without realizing there was an 8-foot crocodile just underneath his mattress. And that's a whole other story that is linked in this article in the Huffington Post. Margaret said, "This may sound odd, but potato eyes. I find them so overwhelmingly repulsive that I can't even think of them without shuddering." Potato eyes. Fred says, "I cannot really explain my fear without telling the whole story, so here goes nothing. This began when I was 12. I had a huge interest in the occult, which may or may not be odd for someone who'd been brought up in a deeply religious family. My mother decided, in an attempt to be ever supportive, to buy me several books that dealt directly with the subject, one of which was The Amityville Horror." Oh, wait, your mom bought you The Amityville Horror? "During one chapter, the main male character wakes up and goes outside to check out a noise. While outside, he looks up and sees his daughter standing at the window, and above her head is the grotesque head of a feral pig with glowing red eyes. That sent me into fits of sleeplessness, which developed rapidly into insomnia and a definite paranoia that if I closed my eyes, that demon pig would appear above me and do something. I don't know what, but something. For a few months, I averaged only a few hours of sleep a night, which caused everything to have a rather ethereal feeling, almost dreamlike. Then I was assigned Lord of the Flies to read for school. During the chapter, when the severed head of the boar starts talking to the boy, I could, thanks to being caught in between sleep and wakefulness, actually hear the thing speaking in the most sickeningly horrific and sweet voice. At this time in my life, I was being bullied unmercifully and went through a deep depression, unlike any I've ever experienced since. I'm 34 now, and I'm still terrified of that stupid demon pig. Not to the point of crawling under the covers, but to the point that if I see anything about the book or movie, I will be prone to night terrors and or sleep paralysis, during which I can feel its presence and hear its thoughts. I know from my own research that this is merely a hallucination common with sleep paralysis, but I don't know how to get rid of this fear. I consider it irrational because I don't believe such things exist." Fred, thank you so much for sharing your phobia on the radio. It sounds pretty intense. Tony says, "Guacamole dip. I can't eat it because it reminds me of The Exorcist." That's right, the green vomit of Linda Blair. "And you will never see guacamole, my friends, in the same way again." As I began the broadcast with a series of quotations, allow me to finish the broadcast with a few more of the same. I thought this one was of note. It was by Maya Angelou. It says this: "What is a fear of living? It's being preeminently afraid of dying. It's not doing what you came here to do out of timidity and spinelessness. The antidote is to take full responsibility for yourself, for the time you take up, and the space you occupy. If you don't know what you're here to do, then just do some good." And finally, a poem by contemporary poet and author Alicia Elsbeth Stallings. She wrote a poem recently called The Fear of Happiness, and it goes like this. Looking back, it's something I've always had. As a kid, it was a glass-floored elevator. I crouched at the bottom of, my eyes squinched tight, or staircase whose gaps I was afraid I'd slip through. Though someone always said I'd be all right, just don't look down or see it's not so bad. The nothing rising underfoot, then later, the high dive at the pool, the treehouse perch, Ferris wheels, balconies, cliffs, a penthouse view, the merest thought of airplanes. You can call it a fear of heights, a horror of the deep, but it isn't the unfathomable fall that makes me giddy, makes my stomach lurch. It's that the ledge itself invents the leap. I like it. The ledge itself invents the leap. Thank you so much for listening to the broadcast. Again, thanks to Dr. Carolyn Rodriguez for her time on the radio. Next Tuesday night, we're going to tell some ghost stories and get ready to have a happy Halloween. And I will see you then on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. Take care.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.